Greek and Roman drama. She's written, for example, on Roman pantomime, and has a speciality in Byzantine reception of Greek drama, and has a speciality in a rather interesting niche, which is attacks on the theatre, particularly religious attacks on the theatre, which can be a very revealing way of finding out what theatre means in a society. If you study the works of people who think the theatre is a bad thing, because, you know, we're all united by thinking what a wonderful thing it is, it's pretty interesting to see the other side of the story. And also has concentrated on the reception of Greek and Roman theatre in the Czech Republic in modern times. And that's the area of today's talk, which is to do with drama during the time in Prague, during the time of the Nazi occupation. So, Alana, thank you very much for coming.
Good afternoon, dear colleagues and friends. Thank you very much for the kind invitation, and I'm really glad I have the opportunity to present my research here, my current research. Before I turn to what I promised, which is the position of Greek tragedy in the national theatre during the Nazi occupation of the protectorates of Czech lands and Moravia, here's the map, how the area changes. I think it can be helpful to introduce briefly also the beginnings of staging of classical drama in the Czech lands, which started in early modern period, perhaps surprisingly, in the curriculum of Catholic Church, where they offered to future intellectuals and elites drama as a tool for education for future intellectuals and elites. Because in the Czech territory, several religious societies had the right to teach, but the most important of them were Jesuits. Specifically, Greek and Roman drama was involved in the system of Jesuit schools, and they developed a very sophisticated system of using drama and teaching at various levels. The Jesuits, who also taught at the Charles University at that time, encouraged students to prepare their own theater activities. In the first half of the 16th century, three productions of Roman comedy are witnessed by the Chronicle of the University. In the case of the first one, we know also about the arrest of the actor in the main role, Bachelor Modri, perhaps for loose behavior in his role. In other towns, there were only high schools, but even there, we encounter ancient drama in their educational programs. As far as we know, although the research on the subject has not yet been too extensive, the Jesuits continued to use ancient texts until they themselves decided to write their own drama. As soon as the members of their order composed their own dramatic texts, the productions of Greek and Roman drama ceased to exist. It was associated with grand demands on censorship and adjustments, and therefore their own texts were more convenient. A large number of German language theatre ensembles was operating in the Czech territory until 1945. Both the big institutionalized theatre houses and travelling companies. Here too, enough research has not yet been done due to various mainly political and historical reasons, and therefore our information on the repertoire is rather fragmentary. It is therefore not safe to rely on the fact that we have documented only a few productions of Greek and Roman drama, see it here. They might have been much more numerous, and we do not know about them. The interest in Greek tragedy increased in Europe after Goethe's theatrical experiments in Weimar in 1807, and equally after Tieck's experiments of 1840s, but we do not notice any immediate increase of interest in Bohemia, similar to that in Europe, not even after Tieck's productions of Antigone in Potsdam. It only came later, at the very end of the 19th century. The first production of ancient drama, Greek tragedy, produced by Czech theatre and spoken in Czech, took place in 1889. It was immediately preceded by several events that significantly influenced its creation. I was unable to find in the sources whether Edith from 1858 in Comédie Française with Jean-Sully gave a guest performance in Vienna in the 80s, so that the Czech audience had the opportunity to get acquainted with it. Still, in 1886, the great premiere of King Oedipus, directed by Adolf Wilbrandt, took place in Vienna, and in the following season, Wilbrandt also produced Oedipus at Cologne's. The scant sources nevertheless prove, without doubt, that Antigone in Donner's translation at the Estates Theatre in Prague from 1887 was a response to the performance directed by Adolphe Darange in Deutsches Theater. A year later, in 1888, Neues Deutsches Theater in Prague played King Oedipus with a satiric epilogue, Euripides' Cyclops, both texts in Wilbrandt's adaptation. In 1889, apparently under this influence, the National Theatre also puts Greek tragedy on the repertoire. The dramaturgs probably did not want to simply adopt a title that was recently staged in Neues Deutsches Theater. After all, there was a kind of competition between Czech and German theaters, and we can't assume that well-situated Czech audience ignored German pieces. On the contrary, it was highly probable that the Czech audience did go to see German productions on a regular basis. Therefore, not Oedipus was chosen, but Antigone. The actor-director, Jakub Seifert, you can see him here, wanted his production to be clearly recognizable as independent on Wilbrandt's ideas, so he resorted to engaging Mendelssohn's music and created harmonious scenes where music and chorus played an important role. The effect was highly esteemed in daily press, even though the production was a hard nut to crack for the reviewers. It was an absolute novelty on the Czech stage and therefore was presented primarily as an instructive piece and also as a sign of the maturity of the Czech theatre culture. In any case, the production marked the beginning of tradition of regular staging of the Czech of the classical drama in Czech and in the Bohemian part of the Austro-Hungarian monarchy. The Antigone was revamped twice, and at the start of the following season, due to the great success of it, Oedipus was included in the repertoire, which, however, did not provoke such a warm welcome. From that moment, all theatres added Greek tragedy and Roman comedy, albeit not quite well understood to their repertoires, as the general feeling was aroused that it belonged to theatre canon. The problem that survives, unfortunately, up to today in Czech theatre was that it did not often meet with a sufficient interpretation. After the initial unease, most of the 86 productions of Greek and Roman drama, so the 86 productions were staged till the occupation, and was staged after 1918. All types of theatres included it in their repertoires. So there were big theatre houses, although they are usually considered rather conservative in their methods of staging. It is necessary to say that several scenes in Czechoslovakia maintained high aesthetic standards and were open to new trends in various ways. Some theatres that we would call commercial today were also very progressive. For example, Schwanda's theatre, in this theatre, Zistrata was first produced on Czech stages in 1923. And there were travelling companies, and their repertoire was often inspired by successful productions in the traditional theatres. We can mention, for example, the traveling Burdas group staging King Oedipus in 1937. And there were many avant-garde studio theatres, experimental and mostly profiled as left-wing. Amateur theatre groups have existed in most Czech towns and many villages, and their grand Enlightenment role during the epoch of the National Revival is acknowledged by the public and by the theatre professionals. For example, by the fact that even today, most famous professional actors perform in amateur productions, as well as professional directors cooperate with amateur groups. You can see one of these productions here from the 30s, by the whole village prepared a production of Oedipus the King, and there was an important national theatre actor, Eduard Koholt, starring as Oedipus the King. And we have radio productions. There were not many, but still there were two experimental broadcasts of Aristophanes and one Sophocles Antigone by the avant-garde directors in the 30s. We can also see what were the most usual dramaturgical preferences of the individual theatres before the Second World War. Until 1923, there was no Greek comedy stage at all. After this year, it had been gradually included in the repertoire of small avant-garde theatres and regional theatres. Aristophanes would appear in the National Theatre only after the arrival of director Jiří Frejka from the avant-garde environment. Before coming to the National Theatre, Frejka, who systematically explored the genre of comedy in his practical and theoretical activities, had already directed several successful productions of Aristophanes, and in 1934 he introduced Birds in the National Theatre. Still, Aristophanes is not at home in the National Theatre even nowadays. Until now, his plays have been staged only four times. Somewhat surprisingly, Aristophanes was not popular among amateurs before war. The situation was slightly reversed only much later, thanks to some very successful adaptations, such as Lysistrata in the 70s. Tragedy, on the contrary, really is at home on Czech stages. It has been played virtually by everyone and everywhere. Already before the Second World War, it became a profile genre of two important directors of the National Theatre, I will speak about in a minute. With some exceptions, tragedy was staged rather for representative reasons. It was considered a piece on which the theatre culture can present its maturity or refinedness. Only a few productions diverted from this trend and inclined towards a truly profound interpretation. And precisely these will be discussed today. Two directors, Jaroslav Kvapil and Karel Hugo Hiller, are considered founders of the modern Czech theatre. The first one belonged to the first generation of theatre artists who had to deal with the Greek drama on the modern stage and probably did not feel comfortable about these texts yet. This is his Orestia from 1907, a production of a beautiful historicizing visual concept that did not bring up any particular interpretation of the text, though. And I would not mention it at all had it not inspired the reaction of a young intellectual and assistant dramaturg at the Municipal Theatre of Vinohrady, which was a suburb of Prague, and a classical philologist inclining to Nietzschean interpretation of tragedy, Karel Hugo Hiller. In 1907, he was a student of classical philology and one of the editors of a progressive book series, The Modern Bibliothèque. He also wrote critical and polemic texts to several cultural journals, often under pseudonyms, one of these being his reaction to the generally celebrated Kvapil's Orestia. Hiller wondered whether it was even possible for a modern human to adequately experience back a production of Greek drama. He pointed out the seeming proximity of Greek tragedy to modern drama. He counted several cultural and anthropological dissimilarities and began with the very context in which the texts are produced. A Greek theater as a collective religious festival with political role opposed to the routine operation of modern theater. An engaged spectator, participant, member of a community against a modern individual who is often not even interested and remains a mere observer. Therefore, he was dissatisfied with the picturesque stage image of Orestia, which in his view did not affect the spectators properly. Later, as a director of the National Theatre, he took a completely different approach to Greek tragedy than his predecessor. He replaced historicism with a dynamic expressionist gesture based on a highly focused and concentrated interpretation of the play. His Medea, followed by Sophocles' Tracking Satyrs, and his production of King Oedipus explored the deranged individuals, obsessed with the aim they set themselves. Especially in the case of Oedipus, Hilar relies on a significant text adaptation in which he ascribed large chorus parts to Oedipus and makes them long soliloquies mirroring Oedipus' mind. The critics pointed out that this change resulted in an image of the Greek hero that was surprisingly close to Dostoevsky's characters. Can't imagine it. Could happen. It was this production of Oedipus that was restored after Hilar's death as a tribute to the exceptional director. Up to this day, it is considered one of the highlights of Czech theater. And there is another director of the young generation in the National Theatre, engaged by Hilar himself from the Municipal Theatre of Vinohrady again in 1922. Still, Karel Dostal is shadowed today by both of the above-mentioned great directors. Although he appears in whole handbooks of theatre history, almost no research has been devoted to his work. My initial interest in his person was also utilitarian, I thought that I would just write a short article about his productions of Greek tragedy, because all the research certainly must have been done. And then I realized that it's not so, that he was neglected, and it was in fact a legacy of a communist era, because Dostal did not suit the Marxist interpretation of the history of Czech theater for many reasons. First of all, Dostal was a director of the traditional or institutional theater, if you want, with a strikingly non-proletarian orientation. And Karel Dostal was born in a bourgeois milieu, and his first wife was a German. And even I remember from my childhood the communists' hatred towards Germans. So, moreover, Dostal was a pious Christian. One more reason for communist historiography to marginalize his importance. And in the 1930s, after Hilar's early death, Dostal stood up against the engagement of the extremely left-wing director Jindřich Honzel in the National Theatre, arguing, like many others, both with aesthetic reasons and the director's unclear political connections to the Soviet Union. After the World War II, Honzel was engaged to the National Theatre right away on the 5th June of 1945, which was less than a month after the end of the war, since the National Theatre quickly turned to the communist direction. And Dostal's journey to the theatre was exceptional in the Czech environment at that time. As I've already mentioned, theatre has been traditionally a highly appreciated art in the Czech society due to the important role it had in the national revival, spreading Czech language, cultivating the national traditions, and being an important factor in the self-definition of the nation against the German subjects. The Czech theatre tradition was therefore traditionally considered to be autochthon, and the actors were educated somehow one by the other. For example, Dostal's sister Leopolda, one of the most important Czech actresses, studied at another legend of the National Theatre, actress Hanna Kvapilová. Therefore, choosing the famous and progressive Berlin acting school Rheinische Hochschule für Dramatische Kunst to gain and improve one's acting skills, as Dostal did, was absolutely exceptional and decidedly influencing his work. As a result of this experience, later his productions were carefully rhythmized and musically accurate. Although intellectually oriented, they addressed emotions and extra-rational components of perception with equal intensity, thus deepening the effect of the scenic artifact. Simplicity of his stage expressions increased in time, and he became far removed from the extravaganza of directors influenced by avant-garde, which was so popular not only among contemporary audiences, but also among Czech theater historians. And these historians were influenced by the revivalist myth of the folk and decidedly anti-classical origins of the Czech theatre. Otherness, different intellectual background, and intellectual demands proposed by Dostal's productions and founded his work also by the contemporary reviewers, could also result in the overshadowing of his personality. Dostal's German career is impossible to be reconstructed in detail, but we know that until the World War I, Dostal was engaged as an actor in German theaters, and these were just some theaters. He had a 2 seasons experience from Meiningen, but also in the one of the Volksbühne movement theaters, a traveling Märkisches Wandertheater with the repertoire based on German classics. In fact, many famous German actors and directors were gaining their experience in this company. I found this photograph in Dostal's inheritance, and I managed to identify it after some research. And it should be Dostal in the role of Pylades in Goethe's Iphigenia at the Märkisches Wandertheater. In 1910 till 1912, he was an actor at Deutsches Theater under Max Reinhardt as a director. And as you can see, he worked there in the years when Reinhardt directed his most important productions of Greek plays. This experience had probably the strongest impact on his career. In several essays, he reflected on Reinhardt's work and his contribution to history of the world theater. But he also pondered on Reinhardt's influence on his own work. And this influence is still visible at a TV recording that I found of one of his productions of Goldoni's Venetian's Widow from the end of the 50s. You can see lightness, purity of style, mobility of the stage design, a pulsating rhythm, the creation of an intoxicating carnivalesque dream world. After he was wounded in the First World War, he worked with Anna Geyer, whom he met actually at the Märkisches Wandertheater and the Neue Wiener Bühne. At the end of the 1918, he returned to the new successor state of the dissolved Austro-Hungarian monarchy, Czechoslovakia. He was over 30 then, searching for a theater engagement, but with poor success. His German training, especially his stage speech, stood out and was out of tune with the other actors. In 1920, he was engaged to the Municipal Theater of Vinohrady, where he soon began directing alongside acting. And in the end, he became more often a supporting actor, but a very good director. In the 1922, he left for the National Theatre, where he was soon assigned as a director to the classical repertoire, which in addition to progressive modern plays, formed important line of his work already before the occupation. So let's look now at his first productions of Greek tragedy, Bacchae from 1927 and his Antigone from 1925. Both these productions are exceptional phenomena in the Czech context because of the deeply thought-out concept of both productions, while the Bacchae brought out to its peak what was conceived in Antigone. Both productions were organized in accordance to the Nietzschean concept of the tension between the Apollinean and the Dionysiac. Actually, Nietzsche's Birth of Tragedy was translated in 1923 for the first time to the Czech language by Dostal's friend and future director of the National Theater, Ottokar Fischer. And I can't prove it, but I believe that they must have met in Berlin in 1907 when he studied there and Ottokar Fischer was there as well. So, Dostal contrasted the rational order of the letter of the visual concept with instinctive intuitiveness of the form. In visual, you can see the flowing and iridescent drapery contrasting to the solid geometry of the stage architecture. There was a construct of dancing chorus organized to the principles of Dapro's Eurythmics, and there were contrasts in acoustic dimension as well. He used expressive rhythm and rhythmic recitation. There was this contrast also in the interpretation of the drama. The conflict was based on a dark conflict of foreign exotic element conquering an ancient home culture. Exotic and foreign world was created on stage, completely dissimilar to the contemporary clichés associated with staging of Greek drama. The critics were rather perplexed, although they mostly didn't dare to raise any strong objections. But in the 30s, Dostal felt and expressed it in his essays that he did not penetrate the core of the aesthetic concept and strived for a new definition of the term classicism. He decided to travel to France and to Germany and deepen his theater experience. And in the end, as he wrote in his essays, he substituted the dead forms of classicist rule with the director's meticulous work with text, serving to the playwright's intentions. And we can say that in the 30s, Dostal reflected on what he would put into practice, partly because of historical circumstances in the 40s. In the years 1939 till 1945, the repertoire of Czech theatres was, of course, greatly restricted by the limitless censorship regulations. Every production of even the hindmost amateur village theatre was subject to censorship. Moreover, we shouldn't forget about self-censorship, further limiting the artist's free expression. While initially the restrictions were set in general terms, for example, authors from countries that were at war with the Reich were not allowed to be staged. A quickly expanding list of specific titles, however, appeared soon. This made it increasingly difficult to put together a repertoire that would be morally impeccable and at the same time varied, of certain quality and attractive for the audience. Theatre played an important role in the complicated social reality of the protectorate. Although most people did not suffer directly from the war turmoil did not pose an immediate threat to the lives of the citizens in the protectorate, there was still a lot to cope with. Imprisonment and death due to racial policy and, of course, more often due to collaboration and denunciation. People lived in material poverty and also in subjugation. They became citizens of a hated state and they weren't given a chance to fight for their country. Theaters therefore often composed a repertoire offering an escape entertainment where the audience could forget frustration of their grim everyday lives. In these circumstances, the great success of simple comedies, often later filmed, so you can watch them if you are brave enough, is not so surprising. The effect was compounded by the fact that staging these teleplays was sometimes the result of despair. They were put into the repertoire because there were too few quality comedy titles available. Although quite some number of interesting productions can be found even in this period. In addition to the already mentioned floods of shallowness, there was also an immense amount of so-called national kitsch to be seen on contemporary stages. The feeling of endangering the national values of the small nations united against their will in the Reich resulted in efforts to cultivate these values with sweet-tuned rural idylls on stage and in cinema, and even in home furnishings and clothing a la nationale. It must have been almost a superhuman task for the National Theatre to set up repertoire in these difficult times of harsh political repression. The aim of their bold dramaturgical decision was to attempt at keeping the honorable tradition, historical relevance, and aesthetic paradigm the National Theatre represented in the pre-occupation era. The dramaturgs managed to navigate between the Nazi Scylla and the characters of its cultural responsibility with surprising skill and dignity. In such a complicated context, Greek tragedy was perceived as a safe area in terms of the repertoire. The choice of acceptable plays was limited, but it was hardly possible to prohibit staging of Greek tragedy in general. For almost every season, as you can see, at least one title of a Greek tragedy was proposed by the dramaturgs of the National Theatre to censors, sometimes highly improbable to get their approval, as you can see. Still, three titles from their list were staged in the end, and I'm going to present their significance in the history of Czech theatre. The dramaturgs František Getz and Miloš Hlávka gradually refined their strategy of getting the required number of titles into the repertoire. In the first two seasons, they seemed to have attempted to put together a coherent plan within the censorship guidelines, replacing later one by another only those titles that weren't approved by the censors. However, the general list of forbidden plays was expanding quickly, which made it gradually harder and harder to compose the repertoire. In the final years, therefore, the dramaturgs chose a different tactic. They submitted a long list of titles, including very exotic titles of Indian and Japanese drama, to the censorship department at the Ministry of the National Enlightenment. The censors cut it short, but quite a few items remained from which the team assembled satisfactory repertoire for the following season. Unfortunately, the censors' explanations of the exclusion of individual plays were not archived in the National Theatre, and in the National Archives, 200 packed boxes are devoted to theatre censorship, of which I have studied only 50 up to this day, without putting hand on anything relevant concerning this issue. Still, it can be guessed why Agamemnon, Oresteia, or Arnold Dvořák's adaptation of Oresteia, as well as Seven Against Thebes, were banned. The repertoire as well promised Plautus Rudens for 1942, replaced later by Pseudolus, perhaps for practical reasons. And the premiere of Eon, originally planned for 1942-43, was delayed and produced a season later. Theatre artists mostly renounced from the radical experiments of the previous era. It was a common decision of most cultural institutions then to use language that was generally comprehensible and did not divide, but rather unite society. As I have mentioned, this obviously didn't always lead to quality and aesthetically acceptable results. Nevertheless, I would like to draw attention to two works that met these requirements in an exceptional way. It seems remarkable and almost unbelievable that Antigone, a supremely politicizing play, where state power is often interpreted as despotic and tyrannic, was allowed to be staged in the National Theatre during the occupation. In fact, it was not even completely exceptional. Antigone was staged during the occupation 6 times, to be precise, not only in Prague, but also by amateurs and in regional companies. And we register also one puppet production. The production in the National Theatre was Karel Dostal's second encounter with the play. However, the change in the contemporary context caused a completely different result now. Although the time did not favor a radical experiment, Karel Dostal did not create a conformist production. At first sight, it may seem that he abandoned his concepts and experiments in order to follow the stereotypes that he previously evaded. On stage, porticos and monumental architecture appeared. Actors wore monochrome, how to call it, bed sheets. The wild whirl of dancing bodies disappeared. However, this first impression is deceptive, as we will see. The director, with his stage designer, František Muzika, modified the visual elements and filled them in non-stereotypical meanings. They did not intend to create a world of superhuman heroes on stage, but a piece of art that would correspond to the needs of the audiences in the time of oppression. In one of his essays from 1940, Dostal reflected the transformation of the social role of theater in occupation. He considered theater a moral institution that defines, unifies, and cultivates the national community. In the difficult historical situation, his approach to classical drama transformed too, from a provocative visual experiment and refined intellectual interpretation of dramatic texts. His productions became more measured and even socially engaged. He put a strong emphasis on the dramaturgical interpretation of the text. In the essay, he expressed his belief that in the case of tragedy, and unlike in most comedies, the director was responsible to the playwright, and his task was to search how to express the playwright's intentions on stage with maximum of aesthetic impact. The time now came for Dostal to follow this task and also to survey in practice another long time question of his, the meaning of the notion classical. Although the censorship affected the text with some significant cuts, Dostal tried to keep the political dimension of the play in the production. He accentuated the theme of personal heroism facing the death. The verse, "Against death alone, she is left with no defense," became the motto of the production. It was repeated by chorus several times in the production. These words were fundamental for Antigone. She was aware of her mortality, but she also knew that her death would gain value only if she died, fulfilling the task she considered sacred. Visually, the oriental opulence and exuberance of the mythical world of Greek youth, which dominated the first Dostal's productions in the National Theatre, was substituted by moderation and order of Winckelmann's vision of a noble Greek man. However, the harmony was undermined by the overall darkness of the stage image. The magnificence of Winckelmannish antiquity was replaced by Musica's dark, stifling tableau of Thebes, peopled with strong, morally uncompromising characters. Dostal transformed them into a kind of superhuman complexes of will and spiritual power. Reviewer Pisha described the characters with these words: spiritualized power, severe pathos, and suffering magnificence, which remind us of Winckelmann's description of Laocoon. His sufferings pierce us to the soul, but we are tempted to envy the great man his power of endurance. Remarkable stage music mentioned in all the reviews, lofty but restrained in the expression, stressed the atmosphere of suspense in Thebes and corresponded to the reverent slowness of the stage action. Olga Shainfugova, playing Antigone, emphasized above all the tension between passion and severity. Her Antigone was superhumanly committed to her sacred task and tried with all her strength to fulfill her mission in a world that turned against her. Shainfugova was restrained in her gestures, suppressing her emotional expression. Only when her Antigone understood that there was nothing left but death, desperate desire to live burst out of her. She cried and moaned, and only then did the actress somewhat release her movements. The production was remembered by spectators as an enormously intensive experience, and more than one critic claimed it wasn't theater, but liturgy. On the chess pages, Medea is almost as frequent title as Antigone, and during the occupation, the play was also staged 6 times. It was produced for the 2nd time at the National Theater, the first production being the work of Pilar in his expressionist period, as you might remember. And at first sight, Dostal's conception looks similar to his Antigone, at least visually. If we look closer, though, we can see that the concept of Winckelmann inside out, or how to call it, is treated differently here. While Antigone was accepted with supreme admiration by the critics, Dostal's Medea aroused contradictory reactions. It was certainly partially due to the fact that Medea can't be presented as a model heroine, as Antigone usually is, and Dostal, inspired by an interpretation of the play by Czech classical philologist Klára Pražáková, set for himself perhaps the most difficult task. He wanted the audience to find sympathy for Medea's solution of the hopeless situation and to perceive her deed as a superhuman act, defying Jason's average desire for domestic happiness and for his easy career through advantageous marriage. Moreover, in his essay, published in a newspaper before the premiere, Dostal introduced Medea as a heroine of female liberation against the patriarchal concept of marriage. Here, the visual aspect of the production did not contradict the conventions associated with staging of classical drama. The brightness of the blue Greek sky under which the graceful white architecture it was the dream of the proportionate white Greece. However, this perfectly harmonized image was only a surface of a quite sophisticated stage concept. In contrast to the rather straightforward rendering of the characters in Antigone, the characters of the main couple here were more complex. Mythically dignified heroes of the old generation, especially Creon and the nurse, clash with the young Jason and Medea, ambiguous, sensitive, and emotional beings who were full of inner dynamics and passion, expressed by the actors' flexible and lively movements and gestures. It was this restlessness that led them to their decisions and actions that gradually destroyed the beautiful world of Corinth. The chorus of Corinthian girls also belonged to the group of young in the play, the group populating the scene by their lively movement and showing their compassion and kind attitude to Medea was united by a unison recitation of the verses, supported by Ponce's music again, standing in counterpoint to the softness of the chorus speech. The orchestral music was strictly rhythmic and extremely powerful. To paraphrase Harold Ostall, Medea was a woman internally agitated, maturing from an instinctive, passionate hatred to a serious and rationally justified decision that was merely a vengeance for her ruined life. But in its greatnessness, it stood as a moral vocation in opposition to Jason's shallow, mundane welfare. Perhaps that was why the catastrophe was crowned by an impressive conclusion following the final scenes of the play, but usually cut from the productions. Here Medea did depart on a winged chariot pulled by two dragons. The last production of the ancient tragedy, which was staged during occupation in the National Theatre, is Euripides' Ion. Up to our days, Ion is perceived rather a complicated play, not easy to interpret, and therefore not too often produced. On the modern Czech stage, it was produced only in 1944 and never since. While Dostal's productions have become important pieces of the Czech theatre canon, Ion is rather an eloquent document attesting the difficult coexistence of theatre artists with rampant censorship. Obviously, the play was put on stage mainly due to the lack of other classical titles not yet banned. The traditional Antigone and Medea were already staged in the previous two seasons. Oedipus was produced with great success in 1936 in the National Theatre and also elsewhere. The dramaturgs then decided to play safe and chose a play that wasn't widely known. In the synopsis attached to the censorship book, the melodramatic storyline of Ion was emphasized and all possibly problematic political themes of the play were suppressed or rather removed. The conflict was in fact summed up into the phrase Ihre Ehe ist kinderlos geblieben, and this situation was introduced as the starting point of the following misunderstanding. The synopsis for censors suffered from several logical weaknesses. It's natural when the political propagandist line of the plot is cut off. But the censors didn't worry about it and gave the production their permission. We can only guess why the play wasn't directed by Karol Dostal, who was usually entrusted with Greek tragedy and classicist repertoire. But in the 1946-1944 season, he directed some extremely demanding pieces, such as Moliere, Lessing, and Grillparzer, which might explain why Aleš Podhorský was assigned a director of Ion. Unlike Dostal, this director followed the old-fashioned realistic aesthetics and directed corresponding theater repertoire. Due to the shrinking of the theater staff during the occupation and narrowing the repertoire options because of the censorship, it was necessary for Podhorský to direct occasionally also plays that were aligned to his style. Since the historical building of the National Theater was closed from March 1943, Ion was produced on a smaller stage of theatre na Vinohradech, municipal theatre of Vinohrady, which corresponded to Podhorský's concept of the play as intimate family drama, calm and tending to psychological rendering of characters and their relations. The leading actor, Karel Heger, was an actor of subtle psychological expression, most renowned for his roles in impressionist pieces. Božena Pulpánová was trained in commercial theatre, Švandovo divadlo, which, however, staged also the progressive modern chamber drama from time to time. Podhorský, with his designer Josef Šálek, created only slightly stylized Greek architecture on the stage, choosing rather stereotypical elements, as you can see. Not surprisingly, characters dressed in historicizing costumes moved on stage in pale dresses, helmets, leather shoes, and wearing wrought accessories based on the stereotypical idea of Greek art at the time. The realistic approach
don't know if I...
Went as far as to that props such as these were listed in the budget of the production with the plastic fruits apparently used in the scene of Xuthos' feast. Critical responses were rather embarrassed, although mitigated by the tendency to positively evaluate everything that happened in the theater during occupation, because any hint of criticism could result in further curtail of Czech cultural life. The lukewarm reception was only partly due to the conforming concept and tame character of the visual aspect of the performance, which however attracted conservative audience. To assess the reception of the production properly, we have to look at the dramaturgical adaptation of the text. It was mainly shaped by censors' demands. In the end, they gave permission to a stage play, where an attempt is made to kill a foreign pretender to the throne of a small but flourishing country, and moreover, the attack is followed by an attempt at a revenge, another murder of a ruler of a country that, in the world of the chorus, was about to flee on a winged chariot. I will explain now. The dramaturg searched the way out of playing Ion without mentioning all these hints to life in oppression and governed by brutal foreigners, as you can see on this slide, and you have it also in your handouts, and were especially anxious about not mentioning Creusa's fear that a foreign sovereign would come to her country and occupy it. Equally, they must have thought how to cope with the two attempts at assassination of the potential ruler and the queen. These motifs could be interpreted as an allusion to the killing of Reich Protector Reinhard Heydrich in 1942, the act which was followed by extreme terror from the part of the Nazi invaders, as we have. Indeed, in this desperate chorus cry expressing Creusa's fear, the audience, well versed in reading between the lines, could discern an allusion to Heydrich's ride in an open car through Prague streets on May the 27th, 1942. On the way from his country house to his office at the Prague Castle, he was shot by the three Czech members of British Royal Air Force, and a week later, Heydrich died. After all the cutting, the text was clear of all these allusions, and consequently also of all the moments where the tension is escalating to the highest, and where the text is emotionally most intense, and thus contributes to the attractiveness of the play. The necessary outcome was a dull text, the effect of which the artist could hardly reverse. Moreover, the conflict lost coherent logic. In the final scene, Ion and Creusa could not even say exactly why they wanted to kill each other, because such a dispute would reveal the political aspect of the play. The dialogue was shortened, and the audience watched unmotivated Ion's jealousy towards Creusa. It was also incomprehensible why the gods would interfere with a family dispute. First, Pythia explained the situation, and then Athena, whose function was completely obscured when the successor line of the story was extracted. Still, the producers apparently tried to keep some allusions in the text that were appreciated by the audience. The discussion of inner freedom in the state of enslavement, which, by the way, made also Freke's Pseudos in 1942 very popular. They wanted to leave words of freedom of speech and pride that cannot be suppressed under slavery law. Such passages served in this production, as well as in Dostal's production, to uplift national confidence. It was precisely this method of hidden communication with the audience that kept the theaters full until they were closed due to Totalansatz shortly after the premiere of Ion in August 1944. The National Theater was reopened in April 1945 by Dostal's production of Goethe's Iphigenia auf Tauris, which well represents the fact that classical and classicizing tragedy was a significant item in the repertoire of the National Theatre. On the one hand, it spoke to the audience with hidden meanings that contributed to their sense of unity, without resorting to the pervasive simplicity, as has often happened in the case of the ever-present national kitsch. On the other hand, the fill-up function of the Greek tragedy is well visible in the last of the above-mentioned productions, the director of the conformist repertoire in the National Theatre, Aleš Podhorský, intended it along with the dramaturg as a non-conflicting escape piece, but due to circumstances, it became a problematic title that it had to be modified to such an extent that it became hardly comprehensible. Still, it remains an important testimony to how lack of freedom limits the creative spirit and distorts artistic message. Thank you for your attention.
Well, thank you very much, Helen. That was terrifically informative and covered a great deal of ground. Can I just ask one clarification thing? The National Theatre, this is the National Theatre of Bohemia, the National Theatre of Czechoslovakia, or it's a single building in Prague, yes?
It's a building in Prague, and it was the National Theatre of the Bohemia and Moravia then. And in the protectorate, of course, Slovakia split from the Czech country,
yeah.
And they collaborated with Hitler. So in that time, it was the Czech National Theatre, from the Czech part. After the Second World War, Slovakia built their own national theatre that now is...
Right. So enlightenment, just again, a little fact. So during the occupation, Slovakia was fully collaborating, but Bohemia, Moravia, what exactly, you say the protectorate, what does that mean?
Czechoslovakia was, I'll show you the map, it will be the first important thing to show again. So, it was in the beginning. This is...
Fascinating pictures.
and it doesn't work.
I'll do this. Which might be a mistake again. There was this first picture. So this is Czechoslovakia before the occupation. And there was a Munich, I don't know how it's called, Munich contract between the Western countries that they will give part of the Czech territory to Hitler. And so in 1939, in March, part of the Czech territory was given to Hitler, and he installed his government to Prague. So we had a puppet president, but the real ruler of the country was Hitler and his officials. The blue parts were completely German, and the rest of it were the dotted part was the so-called protectorate, who had a puppet rulers, Czech rulers, but in fact they were under Hitler's rule. And Slovakia, they managed to split before the occupation, and they collaborated with Hitler and had their own Slovak state. And after 1945, the Czechoslovakia was again installed. That was it.
I'm really interested in this figure, this director, actor, director Dostal, who you've obviously done this really interesting research on, and I wondered if you could tell us a little bit more. I mean, you told us a lot about why in the communist period, he was clearly not someone to study, let alone admire. But I wondered if was there any sense in which he was perceived to be a collaborator? And you talked a lot about his training with Reinhardt and so on, but I was surprised really when you actually saw his stagings, because they really did not look, with possible exception of at least one side of Medea, it didn't really look like Reinhardt either. So first of all, so were there suggestions that he was a collaborator? I mean, and secondly, a little bit more, did he reject Reinhardt or?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so he obviously wasn't a collaborator with the regime. He actually, for example, he collaborated with Olga Šajfrudová, who was Karel Čapek's widow. Karel Čapek was a writer whom, in fact, collaborators with Nazism simply killed, you know, by slander and all that, and he died shortly after the occupation. And Olga Šajfrudová was a person who remained in the National Theatre due to several reasons, but nobody was really happy that she acted on stage. And he continued his cooperation with her. And he did it for many, many actors. And I think it was because he had a German wife. He met his wife during his studies in Germany. He brought her home to Prague. And perhaps this was why the regime said, well, he has a German wife, perhaps he is not in opposition to this regime. So that was why he could work there. And his relationship to Reinhardt's work wasn't simple. He always thought if it was good what Reinhardt did, because he made theater a festival, he attacked the spectator with a lot of effects. So perhaps he thought that maybe it obscured the message of the production. So he always thought, should I do this or shouldn't I do this? And so the relationship was a bit complicated towards Reinhardt. Before the occupation, his influence is more visible in the productions. And during the occupation, it's rather calmer. All his productions are calmer. They are really simple, classicizing. And after the World War, before they pushed him out of the theater, he went back to this. And I think there's also a difference between comedies and tragedies. The tragedies are classicizing even after the war. I'm just thinking that there's also an influence of anthroposophism, because he was anthroposophist, and he put this message into his tragedies as well after the World War. But in his comedies, the Reinhardt influence is really visible, because it's really an opulent visual image and a lot of movement, dancing, the whirl of dancing people, and also the stage design is mobile and changes very easily. That's it.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you very much. Why do you think that they did let Antigone be staged, despite the text being censored, given, you know, you're disobeying the dictators?
I can't say why it remained. You mean why it remained in the repertoire?
Yeah,
why
yeah.
It wasn't cut out? I tried to find out, and I think it's just the method how they put everything on the list for the censors, and the censor simply didn't remark that it might be dangerous to put this on. Because, you know, as I said, there are 200 boxes in the National Archive, and this was the Czech line of censorship. In fact, this censorship went two ways. There was a Czech censorship and also the German line of the censorship. So, in fact, there were all these censors that worked, that, you know, they had piles of papers that they had to read, and sometimes it skipped their attention. So sometimes really strange titles were put on the repertoire because nobody noticed that it might be dangerous. So this was usually this was the way how these strange titles survived in the repertoire. I read the censorship book as well, you know, the text of the Antigone, and the censor did his work really badly. Perhaps he was in a hurry. So almost everything that is strange was remained there, and there were only slight cuts in the text. So it was a mistake of the censorship, I think. And these six Antigones, it was that, because they were played in small towns, so the censors weren't perhaps even educated, because there was a lack of censors in the first years of the protectorate. I read, you know, there were those quotations from the first meeting of the censors when they discussed also how to find more people to do this. And some and usually these people were, for example, lovers of theater who just wanted to earn more money. So they did it in their free time. Some of the censorship were second-rate dramatists, so because they, and these were really dangerous, because sometimes these were the authors who weren't played on stage, so they so they censored the text of the others. So it's really it's a really difficult question, and yeah, I asked many people, why do you think they played Antigone? You know,
there was that fascinating sentence though that people should not applaud.
Yeah.
In order to demonstrate...
Yeah, because there were some accidents. In the, you know, on the first posters from the first years of the protectorate, this wasn't written. Only in from 1942, perhaps, if I remember it correctly, because there were some accidents when people applauded during Fidelio, for example, and this Fidelio was played on Adolf Hitler's birthday. And the people, and there was that area about freedom, they just stood up and applauded.
Yes.
So, well, after that, this appeared on the posters.
Thank you.
Of course, there's a very famous Antigone
yeah.
and censorship in the case of Henri and in Paris, where it seems, I mean, I don't know if anyone here knows a great deal about that, but it seems it was. But it somehow managed to get by both sides.
Yeah.
There's a review of that, Nui's Antigone, where they say, oh, isn't Antigone a good Nazi sympathizer? So she's being read in that case
yeah.
as like positive, as a supportive of the Nazi regime.
Yeah.
It's,
but equally, allegedly the resistance claimed her as well.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's actually in the graph, isn't it, with the French, that both the right and the left claimed during the graph.
Yeah.
I suppose there's also that interesting case of the Brechtian Antigone, where it says, she too ate of the bread that was baked in the dark until it turned against her, or whatever the quote is, roughly. So, yes.
Yes. Yes, Norman.
Could I ask you about what is known about the nature of the audiences? Because I was wondering how many in the audience, or what proportion of the audience, might be aware that certain parts have been censored, and how, you know, what proportion of the audience would just take the play as it was presented?
It's difficult in the case of Greek tragedy, because Greek history, Greek culture, wasn't a part of curriculum, really. There were some schools that taught Latin, but not many, and it was on the Latin, and it was really simple. So the people, usually the people went to the National Theatre, especially to the National Theatre, really because it was a legend, it was a place connected to their identity. There was a bit of national revival as well, that the people collected money to build it. So they went there due to these reasons. So they didn't want, actually, most of them didn't want to see the actual play, but to go to the National Theatre to present his loyalty to the Czech culture. So and there was really a lot of national kitsch in the National Theatre during the occupation. But they simply went there because of that. There was educated part of the audience who appreciated this, all this that I showed you. But in fact, I don't know if I can say it was minority, but not, definitely not all of them. So they knew that it was censored, but they didn't know what was cut off, what was changed.
Yeah. I had a similar question about the censor, which you know you partly answered when we were talking about smaller town. You know, who appointed the censors and who censored the censors, if you like. I mean, I was just wondering whether, for instance, there might have been censors who let through some of the important bits and made minor cuts in order to show they were doing a job. I don't know. Has any work been done on the censorship in general?
Not really. Not really. People think that I'm crazy that I'm reading all this. And there was some work on the literary censorship, but it worked differently, as I found out. And I think, there were censors definitely who let some plays go in the, you know, in the small villages. I believe there were some of these, but the National Theatre, it was under the magnifying glass. So the censors were really strict and tried to do their best to cut everything out.
Yeah. And am I right that Czech translations into Czech were not widely available in print?
They were available. After 1918, there was quite a lot. Almost everything was translated already, and was available in print. And usually the texts that were translated and circulating were somewhat adapted or changed for stage. As in the case of Medea, the translation of Medea by the same translator is completely different for stage, which I was surprised because nobody knows that. I just found out that it's like that.
There was a published version and a stage version?
Yeah, and they differed. So the translator, who is usually or widely known as a person who didn't understand theatre, actually made something really different in the case of the production in the National Theatre. So the texts were available, and whoever wanted had the opportunity or the possibility to read it.
Yes, well, there's a couple. So one question, two questions, and then tea.
Forgive my ignorance.
Yes, if you could, could you be a number two? There's somebody just in front of you.
Thank you so much.
Yes.
The Czech National Theatre occupies obviously a very important national consciousness. I was wondering, did any of the audience or critics spill over into other countries that were occupied? Was there international interest? Or because of the censorship, was this very much kind of confined to the Czech sphere of influence?
You mean if there was some international response to the?
Indeed, I mean, were there similar engagements with these particular productions in other occupied territories? Was there an interest within the German Reich itself? Or did this largely stay confined to the Czech sphere?
Unfortunately, due to the language barrier, it was confined to the Czech territory, and in fact, in Dostal's case, he had some friends in Germany from the earlier years of his career who saw some of these productions. I found some letters, but that's it. Before the World War, there was a large German minority, and the German critiques sometimes wrote about Czech productions, but it ceased completely after the occupation. Because, one important thing, of course, these parts that were given to Hitler, they were inhabited mostly by Germans. So when the Germans went to Reich,